This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes.
The unrestricted exercise of power by one over another, whether it's an individual, an institution, or a government, will always lead to harm.
Speaker-designate Richard Corcoran brings big change to the Florida House.
Buckle your seatbelts because it's going to be an interesting ride, because he never drives in neutral. It's always forward and full steam ahead.
The legislature's organization session is in full swing.
When other kids were spending spring break at the beach, I was here with my dad at the Capitol, watching, listening, and learning.
Freshman Senator Lauren Book, daughter of powerful lobbyist Ron Book, snags a leadership role. And in an episode of Follow the Money, the capitalist takes a closer look at some environmental groups.
That really speaks volumes in terms of how the Everglades Foundation and perhaps how Paul Tudor Jones is able to influence all these other smaller groups.
We have all that and more on episode 84 of The Rotunda. Welcome to The Rotunda. The Florida legislature is back in session this week. Well, temporarily. They're just in Florida's capital to get organized, welcome new members, and get down to a little business. House members elected Miami Republican Jeanette Nunez as Speaker Pro Tem for the 2016-18 term. Nunez took her time in the spotlight to say a few words about Speaker-designate Richard Corcoran, who's already laying down the law in the Florida House.
Speaker-designate Corcoran is bold, he's principled, and he's visionary. He's someone who's always thinking ahead and always looking at ways to upend the proverbial system, in case you haven't noticed.
Oh, we've noticed. Corcoran is cracking down and kicking out business as usual, especially when it comes to the often cozy relationships with members and lobbyists.
Buckle your seatbelts because it's going to be an interesting ride, because he never drives in neutral. It's always forward and full steam ahead. And I, for one, look forward to charting the course of this body alongside him.
So let's talk about some of those changes with the House's YouTube video, which breaks down some of Corcoran's new rules.
And your speaker-designate, Richard Corcoran, wants you to know that big changes mean improvements in accountability, openness, fairness, and professionalism.
Number one.
All earmarks must be filed as standalone bills and be voted up or down. No more slipping millions of dollars of spending in at the last minute.
Number two.
No member of the House can come back and lobby their former colleagues for 6 years after they leave elected office. The revolving door is closed.
Number three.
No member of the House can go into business or have a financial relationship with a lobbyist. Elected officials swear an oath, and there will be no divided loyalties in the House.
Number four.
Lobbyists will now have to immediately and publicly declare online which bills they are trying to influence and who is paying them.
Number five.
No member of the House will be allowed to fly on a private jet owned or paid for by a lobbyist. Ever. Period.
But wait, there's more.
The House will have a zero tolerance policy for sexual harassment. Members, staff, and lobbyists will act professionally, or they won't be welcome in the Florida House. We even extended the amount of time between when a bill can be introduced and voted on to make sure everyone reads the bills they vote on.
You know, I really do like the rollout and all the planning that appears to have gone into Corcoran's unveiling of his new rules. From the YouTube video, slick graphics, and I even noticed the House's website has been changed. However, not for the good. There is a static page with a message from the speaker and nothing else. No tabs to click on, nothing to get away from it. To see all the other important tools like the schedule. Anyway, here is Speaker-designate Corcoran speaking to his members.
What will guide me over the next 2 years is I try very, very hard to do my best to remember what's my why. And since we're going to be governing together for 2 years, I thought it was important that I share it with you. My why is truth, goodness, and beauty. I believe in a truth that is knowable and objective. I believe in a truth that is rooted in our shared history and humanity, that teaches us that the unrestricted exercise of power by one over another, whether it's an individual, an institution, or a government, will always lead to harm. Power erodes morality, conscience, and character.
To help discuss more about these changes, I met up with Orlando Sentinel's Gray Roar.
It's just pretty astounding. We'll just have to see how it works in practice.
We're hanging out at a coffee shop in Midtown Tallahassee.
The major change is what Richard Corcoran is doing with the house rules, and they're kind of a little arcane. Certainly since I've been up here, anyone has used changes to the house rules to change the process in such a massive way before, because that is going to be a huge, huge change as far as the sausage making process, the way lobbyists, lawmakers, even the press, because there are a lot of transparency changes as well that we'll be able to see, you know, who's lobbying for what now in a way we weren't able to before. So it's just pretty astounding. We'll just have to see how it works in practice, because on paper, they're just massive changes.
Is it a big deal? Should we really take a moment and really step back and look at what's happening here, or is this just talking points? Will we be able to track these changes, go to a website and actually see who is registering and who's asking for what?
Well, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. So, like I said, we're going to have to wait and see how it actually plays out in practice, just like, you know, everything else. But I think the changes that have been put forth and seem to have support and bipartisan support from Democratic House members will be passed. And then we'll just have to wait and see when the first time a lobbyist doesn't report what he or she is trying to lobby on, what happens then?
Yeah, we don't know the consequences.
No, those aren't, you know, sort of laid out. But at the very least, it's on paper that's the principle that they're going to be trying to uphold. And you know, as a member of the press, I'm for one pretty excited about being able to go and see, at least in theory, what you know some of these interest groups are trying to get done.
I want to know from you in the press corps, what would happen if a lawmaker in the House is caught texting? Maybe they're texting you about coming outside to give a quote or something. Do you do that? Like, you're like, no? Like,
I don't.
How does it restrict?
Well, first of all, I don't think that provision applies to me, because I'm a member of the press and not a lobbyist, so I think that's specifically...
But who's going to be policing that? Like, you know, if Richard Corcoran is seeing somebody texting over there, just peering over, hey, pay attention up here, stop that.
That's a good question, because I don't, you know, the answer is who knows? I don't know if anyone knows, so, you know, we'll have to see where the rubber meets the road on that.
So coming out of this election, like you talked about earlier, the beating that Democrats received, it even happened, like, you know, statewide, legislatively. They didn't pick up a lot of seats in the legislature, still are Republican-controlled. So what does this mean for the future?
It means that Democrats are going to have to get used to being in the minority.
As if they're not.
For a longer period than they thought they were going to have to. If you remember, this was the year that things were supposed to at least indicate like they were changing because of the redistricting. There were special session after special session and lawsuit after lawsuit, and the Democrats, for the most part, won those out. They won in court over and over again. They got the districts, at least in the Senate, the way they wanted them, and they won one extra seat. So that's about as poor as they probably could have done in the elections, at least on the Senate side. And now they're heading into 2018 without a whole lot of direction as far as where to go. I mean, who's the leader of the Republican Party? Who's the leader of the Democratic Party in Florida right now? Where do they go? Who is driving that train? I don't think anyone knows the answers to those questions.
All right, so what are you tracking? What's on your radar going forward? What's the next big story?
For Orlando and the Orlando area, there's been a lot of big things that have happened in the interim besides the regular Florida stuff. We're going to be looking at what, if anything, the legislature does in response to the Pulse nightclub shooting. Because that was such a huge tragedy, and there was a lot of fallout. If you remember, the Democrats really called for a special session. It was rejected by the Republicans to sort of look at this terrorist watch list and, you know, delay gun sales bill. And so I think some of the debates and discussion over there can get pretty heated, but, you know, we'll just have to wait and see what, if anything, they are going to do with it.
All right. Well, Gray Aurora, thank you so much for speaking with me here on the Rotunda.
Thanks very much, Bill. Appreciate it.
This is the Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes. The House Democratic leader is Jeanette Cruz of Tampa. Let's turn things over and check in on the Senate. Senate President-designate Joe Negron's priority in 2017 is promoting education from universities through K through 12. Senate President Pro Tem is Annie Terry Flores. When the 2017 legislature gavels in, we will have 66 new members learning their way around the Capitol. One of those standout freshmen is Lauren Book. Yes, walk a mile in her shoes, as many have done to raise awareness about child sexual abuse. As a freshman, she has already been elevated to Senate Democratic leader pro tem.
Standing here is almost surreal to me. I've had great respect for this process my entire life. I began coming here as a little girl with my brother and sister. When other kids were spending spring break at the beach, I was here with my dad at the Capitol, watching, listening, and learning. I even remember my little brother riding his tricycle through these hallowed halls, much to my dad's shock and chagrin. As I got older and experienced some things in my life that no one should ever have to experience, I learned that the members of the legislature took their job seriously and to heart.
And the Senate's Democratic leader is Oscar Brainin, who received a special video tribute from his friends and family, including his father, who is a fan of the Rotunda. Congratulations, Oscar Brainin Sr.
Congratulations, Oscar. I'm very proud of you. We both are very proud of you. You have done it with class. You've done it with dignity, while still maintaining who you are.
As a little boy, when you begin to ask questions, as we would go to work, as we worked in the community, that was just the clue that you would one day do what you're doing now.
You know, I'm excited and happy because when I started in the Senate, we were 12, and in 2 years we were 14, and now we're 15. So we're heading in the right direction. You know, but the weight of it gets heavy. It gets heavier to carry as we grow. But this weight, with the right momentum behind it, is also what makes us a force to be reckoned with.
So that's what this week is all about, a little organizational session before the Thanksgiving holiday. You're listening to The Rotunda, a podcast about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. Visit rotundapodcast.com. Follow us on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, you name it.
Look! I got beans, greens, potatoes, tomatoes, lamb, ranch, pork, beans, greens, potatoes, tomatoes, chicken, turkeys, rat, you name it! Beans, greens, potatoes,
fill out our listener survey on rotundapodcast.com and let us know what you think about this program. And as always, thanks for your support. Did you get that challenge? You name it. Challenge, it is everywhere. Shout out to the producer, Remix God Suede. He made this beat to the You Name It Challenge from scratch, using a sermon over 20 years old from Shirley Caesar, and remixed it out of pure creativity that has taken over and has gone viral. So, that's the person to thank for the green beans, tomatoes, potatoes, Shirley Caesar. Remix God Suede. So, giving him a little love here on the Rotunda. As we wrap up this week, I check in with the capitalist publisher, Brian Burgess, who's been working on a series of stories on his website focusing on some of the state's notable environmental groups that tracks Everglades restoration. Well, Burgess is back to talk about his findings.
All right, Brian Burgess, welcome back to the Rotunda. So you've been working on a series basically looking at the funding source of some environmental groups and what seemed to be a coordinated effort. I'm not surprised by this. It seems like, you know, most organizations, like, you know, you try and find ways to pool your resources. But what were your findings in this series looking at some of these environmental groups?
Yeah, well, money's the lifeblood of politics. And if environmental groups are going to play politically, they need money. And, you know, what I've found is that the Everglades Foundation seems to be a financial clearinghouse for a number of other groups, and it's difficult to say exactly how many at this point, but certainly there's, you know, even in their most recently filed disclosures, you know, they fund a number of other environmental groups, and the end result of that is those other groups are very dependent on what the Everglades Foundation wants them to do, and sometimes that costs them and kind of forces them to toe the line in terms of what their mission is and what they end up doing.
So, Paul Tudor Jones, you spotlighted his effort there. Who is he, and why is he so focused on environmental activism?
Paul Tudor Jones is a very wealthy guy. He runs the Tudor Hedge Fund, and he has a house in Connecticut and a place down in South Florida, a mansion, $71 million mansion. He's one of the founders of the Everglades Foundation, and he's annually one of their biggest donors. He drops, you know, millions of dollars to the Everglades Foundation, and then they disperse those funds to other groups as well as using his money for their own operations. So he's instrumental to how they operate.
You mentioned he has like a sort of checkered past, and he's not the environmental champion as people now see him to be.
Yeah, Paul Tudor Jones isn't the cleanest guy. He's not the poster boy for environmental cleanliness. He has been fined in the past up in, I want to say, New York or Connecticut for flooding some wetlands without a permit. He paid a $2 million fine, and his contractor actually went to jail. And even his own reasoning for founding the Everglades Foundation was more about his own personal desire. He likes to fish, and he wants to keep up property values in the area where he lives, and so he's trying to keep his certain areas pristine, which I understand. Everybody wants to, you know, to have a nice, clean environment. But his motivations are really suspect in a lot of ways in terms of why he wants certain things to be done a certain way. And so he donates money, and then whatever he tells the Everglades Foundation, obviously they're going to do what they can to keep their donor happy. There's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, you just have to consider where the money's coming from and why a donor might give something. And I think in Paul Tudor Jones's case, it's almost as if it's sort of a penance. He's paying the Everglades Foundation to pay for his past sins. So that's why I find it peculiar.
There's an interesting situation involving the Audubon Society and the Cape Sable Seaside Sparrow. What is that all about?
Well, if I can say Cape Sable Seaside Sparrow a few times in this piece, then my tongue-twisting skills are pretty good. The Audubon Society, it's actually the Tropical Audubon Society, authored a piece in a publication where they basically said that they no longer felt like the Cape Sable Seaside Sparrow was as important as buying the land was important. They wanted Everglades restoration to proceed, which requires, in their view, buying the land. And they felt like the Cape Sable Seaside Sparrow was just too finicky of a bird to be able to handle, you know, the renovations or whatever was required to get Everglades restoration moving fast enough to suit them. Mm-hmm. And I found that it was very interesting because the Audubon Society is all about protecting birds. It's not about protecting swampland or things like that. It's about protecting birds. And immediately when that piece was posted, even a federal official commented on that news story and basically said, no, I think you're wrong and you need to relook at this. So obviously it was a very controversial position, and it begs the question, why would they be pushing this kind of a narrative out there when it goes totally against their core mission?
Mm-hmm. And I saw they actually came back, the conservation director, Aaron Clancy, came back and tried to restate the position of the Tropical Audubon. But as you mentioned, that federal official who came out and said, like, you know, they normally don't even comment, but they felt the need to jump out and stop this story from spreading, this position.
Yeah, it was so far out of character for a group that, that prides itself on protecting the birds and certain species of birds that it got a lot of attention. It got attention from my publication. It got attention from the federal government. And I think there was probably some pressure put on by either other donors to the Tropical Audubon Society or someone. But obviously, they weren't being true to their mission, which is why they got slapped down a little bit and why she submitted the correction to that piece. But again, if you go back to that initial story and how they're pushing out this other agenda that has nothing to do with their core mission, that really speaks volumes in terms of how the Everglades Foundation and perhaps how Paul Tudor Jones is able to influence all these other smaller groups.
And with those smaller groups, some say groups like Bull Sugar and the Captains for Clean Water also share same funding source. Is that your understanding?
Well, there's people that suggest it, and I know Bull Sugar has not answered the question about who is behind their operation, and I don't guess they're under any obligation to do that. But there are some requirements for nonprofits and political organizations to file and disclose who their funders are. The Everglades Foundation, interestingly, has not yet filed for 2015, at least not as of prior to the election. I haven't checked since the elections happened. There's been a lot of other things happening. But prior to the election cycle, Everglades Foundation was still delinquent for 2015. And it's a curious thing when there's a lot of money being moved around, especially during the political season, and there may be some motivation for why they don't want to file. I don't know. But I did reach out to the Everglades Foundation, but they got no response. So I don't know when they plan to file that, but that should tell us who else they're funding and if these other smaller groups are actually beholden to the Everglades Foundation as well.
What responses have you received from the groups you call out in your series? Any pushback, objections, concerns?
No, obviously I'm a conservative writer, and I think I'm a known entity in Florida. And so when my email drops in an inbox, I think they kind of know maybe I'm going to write with a slant or whatever. Okay, fair enough. But I mean, some of the things I'm saying here are just what are the facts, and why haven't you filed your report? There's no slanting that. Either you've filed it or you haven't. And I can't blame them for not responding to me. But the fact is, I have reached out to some of these guys and they haven't responded back.
All right. So what's next?
Well, we'll see. There's always, now that the election's over, there's a lot of disclosures that have been filed and a lot of things to sift through, a lot of new information, a lot of new data. One of the things I think is interesting is that the Everglades Foundation's pledge that they had signed, that they asked people to sign, which is Now or Neverglades, the candidates did very, very poorly across the state. And Senator Negron's big push is for buy the land as well. So how that, the prospects of all those candidates, I think 41 out of 55 candidates lost. And I think that has a pretty substantial impact on what the legislature looks like, on what the priorities are going to be for the legislature. And so Senator Negron may want to push that, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of support for it. So it's going to be an interesting thing to watch.
Brian Burgess, publisher, The Capitalist, thank you for joining me again.
Good to be here.
I attempted to reach out to Aaron Clancy regarding the opinion piece on the Cape Sable Seaside Sparrow, and I didn't hear back by this program's deadline. We'll be sure to include if they have a follow-up comment. Now, what does a Trump presidency mean for Florida's top officials? Here's what Gray Rohr with the Orlando Sentinel had to say.
Obviously, with Scott and Bondi and, there's been some other names. Jeff Miller's been linked with the VA post, and I think Mike has been linked with the transportation stuff. So,
John Micah?
Yeah. I'm sorry. John Micah, who lost his seat, sort of Seminole County, Orange County-based seat district. One of the few bright spots for Democrats on election day. But, I think the big one for the state government is if Bondi actually winds up taking some sort of post, because then governor will have to appoint an attorney general, and that'll shake things up a bit. But obviously, Governor Scott isn't going anywhere. He said that all along, and so there's no big change as far as that goes.
He's not going anywhere until 2018, or he's hoping. Did he come out and set the record straight on that? Is he more firmly hinting that he will make a run?
He said it was an option for him, so that's the first time he's actually addressed it, that he's potentially thinking about it, but I don't think anything's set in stone yet, as far as he's concerned. But it does look more and more like that's what he is doing. I mean, he's got a political committee that he's continuing to get money for, and you know, he's looks like he's playing in the RPOF chair race again. So there's all sorts of intrigue and indications that that's what he wants to do. But this is Florida, so you got to be cautious with you know, saying things are definitely going to happen or not.
That's it for this edition of The Rotunda. Special thanks to Orlando Sentinel's Gray Roar and The Capitalist's Brian Burgess. Remember to visit rotundapodcast.com, take a moment to fill out our listener survey, and be sure to join us again next week right here for more stories about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes.